Community Radio, broadcasting all over the world from Madison, Wisconsin. You just heard A Public Affair with Douglas Haynes. Coming up next is Madison Bookbeat. We actually have a new host today, which I'm looking forward to hearing. Bill Hischler, he is speaking with four different guests in today's studio about book clubs in the Madison area, so it should be good. Before that, we will have BBC headlines and a few station announcements. Keep it here on 89.9 FM. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Une fois qu'elle t'a senti le nom, tu t'allonges sous ton dos.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Eileen McHugh with the BBC News. The first public prayers for Pope Francis, who died early on Monday morning, are being said in St. Peter's Square in Rome this evening. Large groups gathered for the rosary, which was recited by a senior Vatican cardinal. Inside the Vatican, the body of the Pope is being placed in a coffin. Pope Francis, who was 88, was the first Latin American Pope. Lebu de Seco has more.
I think that he will be remembered for two things primarily. One is what he set out, you know, on the first day of his papacy, as he said, he wanted his church to be a church of the poor. The second thing I think he'll be remembered for is his focus on the environment, on climate change. And that was an article of faith. He saw that as part of his duty as a Christian.
At the time of his election, Pope Francis was regarded as being on the liberal wing of the church. He softened the Vatican's language on issues like divorce and same-sex marriage and reached out to leaders of other faiths, but he did not try to change the church's traditionalist teachings. Much of his papacy was dominated by the spectre of child sexual abuse. More from Danny Eberhard.
There were flare-ups in politics too. Pope Francis challenged President Trump's plans to deport migrants. And last year, he angered Ukraine and some of its allies when he appeared to suggest that Kyiv should have what he called the courage of the white flag and negotiate an end to the war against invading Russian forces. Some likened this to appeasement. The Vatican later sought to clarify the Pope's comments. It said he was urging a cessation of hostilities reached through negotiations, but hoped for a just and lasting peace.
Danny Eberhard reporting. Pope Francis had chosen not to be buried in the Vatican like most of his predecessors, but in the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore, in an area of Rome which many immigrants have made their home. The conclave to elect his successor will not begin for at least 15 days, with 135 cardinals eligible to vote. Harry Farley has more details.
Already, cardinals from around the world will be arranging travel to Rome. 135 of them under the age of 80 are eligible to form the conclave to choose Francis's successor. He appointed most of them. They will vote in secret twice each morning and each afternoon in the Sistine Chapel, writing the name of their chosen candidate on a piece of paper. Until one man has a two-thirds majority, the cardinals are cut off from any news or messages from the outside world, sleeping and eating in a nearby Vatican hostel. Their phones are taken from them. The chapel is swept for listening bugs.
Harry Farley reporting. This is the latest world news from the BBC. Medics in Sudan say the number of people killed in the western region of Darfur has risen to more than 600 in less than 10 days, the largest mass killing of unarmed civilians since the start of the war. In the latest attack on Sunday, the Sudan Doctors Network says more than 20 people were killed and dozens were injured by the paramilitary RSF in the besieged city of El Fasher. The White House says President Trump stands strongly behind his defence secretary, Pete Hegseth, after reports emerged that he shared sensitive military information on a second chat group that included his wife, brother and personal lawyer. related to the same attack on Houthi rebels in Yemen. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports.
The operational details, including the flight schedules for the fighter jets targeting Houthi rebels in Yemen, were shared on the Signal app. This is the second time the Defence Secretary is found to have been sharing attack plans this way. A journalist was mistakenly included on a separate Signal group and also saw advanced military plans. President Trump has said he has great confidence in his Defence Secretary, saying he's doing a great job, and dismissing the Signal story as fake news from disgruntled employees at the Pentagon.
President Sheinbaum says her government has asked Mexico's TV channels to pull a Trump administration advertisement because it could incite violence. The ad, warning against undocumented migration, has been aired during primetime programs such as football games. Ms. Sheinbaum said it contained a discriminatory message that violated human dignity. Officials in Tunisia have arrested a prominent lawyer and fierce critic of the country's president. Ahmed Sawab's arrest comes days after a court handed down long jail terms to a group of senior politicians, businessmen and lawyers on charges of conspiring against state security. The defendants each receive sentences of up to 66 years in prison. BBC News.
Literacy Network invites you to join them as they celebrate adults reaching their goals through free adult literacy education at their annual Reading Between the Lines fundraiser. From 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, April 24th at the Black Business Hub, you can enjoy wine tasting, hors d'oeuvres from student-owned restaurants, live mariachi, and a program that features stories from Literacy Network students and supporters, including community leader Joanne Burrish telling her own immigrant story. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, earning their GEDs, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at litnetwork.org/RBTW2025. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 20th.
The time is now 1:07, and you're listening to Madison Bookbeat here on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host for today's show, Bill Tischler. Book clubs, that's the topic for today's show. A book club is a great way to meet new people and share similar interests. A book club can foster a sense of community and open up your mind to new ideas. Joining me in the studio today are four guests who have all participated in recent book club discussions with me this year. Amani Latimer Burris is our first guest. Amani worked as an investigative journalist and a grassroots organizer for campaigns at the local, state, and national level. She recently served with me on the Common Council as the Alder for District 12. Joe Grande is a water resource manager at Madison's Water Utility, where he directs the water supply and water quality units. Also joining me is Patrick Cunningham. Patrick serves as Madison's homegrown kids entertainer, Pogi the Yogi, as well as a passionate community wellness teacher, blending yoga, strength training, and meditation to inspire joyful movement and mindful living for all ages. And finally, Ben Varick. Ben works for the Wisconsin Bike Fed as the youth programs manager in Dane County. He helps students walk, bike, and bus to school or to wherever they want to go. Amani, Ben, Joe, Patrick, thank you for joining us in the studio today. Now, for transparency, I'm a City of Madison Alder representing District 11. And since stepping into this role, I've been hosting a community book club at the Sequoia Library. Over the years, we've explored a wide range of topics that impact our community, from free parking to zoning to public transportation and the environment. We even tackled a book about how minds change, which sparked one of probably my favorite discussions, Can Politicians Change Their Minds? Now, earlier this year, the District 11 Book Club, we discussed Charles Vogel's 2016 book, The Art of Community, Seven Principles for Belonging. Now, I'm going to start with you, Amani. I'm going to put you on the spot. You're a community leader. You've been part of several District 11 book clubs. Now, after reading The Art of Community and taking part in the book club discussion, what were some of your biggest takeaways, and how do you see book clubs like the one you attended helping to create a sense of community, shared purpose, and belonging in neighborhoods?
Wow. Thank you, first of all, for having me, Bill. And I'm surprised that you invited me because I was his council mate, and I'm always borrowing stuff or talking too much or trying to see what he's doing. But when I went to the book club discussion, you invited me, and I've been to several. I mean, they're just fantastic. Talk about building community. That's the art of community, and building community is right within what you do. So one of the things that impressed me was there's all these different subjects within a city, and we need to know so much, and the community wants to know so much. So I love how you have set it up to take a topic that affects community, bring in the experts, sometimes bring in the author, and we have a discussion, and we get different points of view, which is all about creating community, being in community, and doing community right then and there. As far as the takeaways for The Art of Community, I mean, there's just too many to list. This is a simple but deep book, and it's apropos for the time. It's exactly where we are in society right now. The kids coming up are feeling lonely and disconnected. We as adults are feeling lonely and disconnected, and we want to make change, and we want to know how to do impact. So I think that's what I really learned. Yeah. What else do you want to know? How does it keep a shared purpose and belonging? Well, if you took this around the city, you would have so many people turn out because people are craving one-on-one and feeling like they're part of something. We all want to belong. We are all lonely, even at the top.
Yeah. Well, the author of The Art of Communities describes community as a group of individuals who share a mutual concern for one another's welfare. He also identifies one of the seven principles as a dedicated space, either physical or symbolic, that holds the community together. Now, Patrick, as an active member of your neighborhood community, what are some of the annual events that go in your community, and how does this create a sense of community?
That's a good question. Thanks, Bill, and thanks for having me on. Maybe it's just the cold weather and the wind today, but I'm really drawn to, we do Westmoreland Summer Nights throughout the summer, which is this concert series in the park, and I've been lucky enough to be there from the beginning. Our neighborhood association president, Jesse Check, you know, originally had the idea of, like, let's get some music in the park, bring people together. And the first time we did it, we were just scrambling, bringing stuff together and kind of neighbors pitching in, coming together to put this on. And now it's grown to a really big event. I think the last one, there's like 1,000 people there, or whatever the appropriate number for the city park regulations is. It was certainly under that number, I know that. But a significant amount of people. And it was so fun. It's just, you, when you go to the park and you see kids and families just being joyful and having a good time together in person, present in that moment, it's such a wonderful thing. So that happens every summer. There's quite a few of them that happen now. I think we're up to 4 or 6 throughout the summer and into the early fall. And then Westmoreland has a historic 4th of July parade that they've been doing for such a long time. And again, summertime, beautiful weather, people are out having a great time. And the other thing, one of the things I really love is the Halloween parade. So if you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it, because there's so many people in the neighborhood that play musical instruments. And so they come together and they do a whole marching band down through the neighborhood streets, and everyone's in costumes, and it's just a great way to celebrate and bring people together. And I think that's the key thing when it comes to a sense of community, is coming together, you know, as you are, in whatever shape or form that may be, because we all have our internal struggles throughout the day, whether we're tired or energetic or happy or sad or everything in between. When we just show up and be present with each other, it's amazing what can happen. I think that's really where we go from being individuals to coming together, contributing however we are in that moment, to being a stronger community together.
Now, the author believes that we are, quote, one of the loneliest generations in American history. He writes in the book, many of us suffer isolation in our lives, even though we are connected more than ever through technology. What we long for is belonging, the feeling of being known and accepted. Now, Amani, Patrick talked about kind of community gatherings, people coming together, but But who are we sometimes leaving out in our community? And who might not feel accepted?
You know, that's not an easy question because, I mean, you can look at it like I could say, you know, the BIPOC community, LGBTQ. We've experienced this at council. We have the most, we had the most diverse council in the history of Madison, in the history being 125 years. And we all come from different perspectives, and we all want to contribute. But one of the things that I want to just read you in the book that struck me right from the beginning, it says, this is in the art of community, and it talks about the fact that we're in, when we are in deep community, we can be vulnerable and we still know how to belong. And I think in today's society, we are in complete violation of this all the time. So everybody at some point feels left out because they feel like whatever they're advocating, you know, Ben is advocating for bikes. If I'm not listening and hearing and connecting, he might feel left out. Certainly as a Black woman in Madison, Wisconsin, I feel left out a lot. Certainly there's different parts of the LGBTQ community, the trans community specifically right now, that's feeling left out. And so our job is to back each other up and not agree, but come to an understanding of, you know, what you do, Ben, with bikes, or understanding you, Joe, with your work to change how the drinking water that we're in, or Bill, for you to bring us all together at this table. We're all diverse and we're here. So everybody feels left out. And what do we do to reconnect? I think that's really important. And this book lays out the principles. It's a deep read. It's really a deep read.
Patrick, you bring people together to teach meditation and mindfulness. You know, what do you see are the effects of loneliness, people feeling isolated, and what are some of the things that you do to kind of bring people together, make people feel more connected?
I think the effects question is interesting because you can oftentimes see it from the outside because you recognize that feeling of like, oh, I recognize that furrowed brow. That's the same thing I do when I'm feeling left out or I feel isolated and lonely. But I think you certainly see it in the sense of, you know, depleted energy and people just not engaged and not present and then going to the technological crutch of picking up their phone and looking at that, looking for another dopamine hit when, you know, there's businesses that's billions of dollars of industry to keep your attention on this device instead of turning around, being present with the people in the room with you. So I see that all the time. Also in people that feel, they don't feel grounded. They don't feel stable. They feel constantly discombobulated and that they're, you know, kind of chasing one thing or another that's going to try and make them happy. And it's that constant searching for happiness, which is kind of like in the olden times when we used to use a remote to click through channels. There's always that, well, maybe there's something good on the next channel, maybe on the next channel, on the next channel. We keep doing that, searching for that external stimulus that's going to make us happy or make us whole, instead of being present in the moment, realizing that no matter what's going on externally, on the inside, we are whole and present just by being here. The fact that we are here is a statistical miracle, that we're these walking, you know, bones and muscles and flesh with these thinking thoughts and these feelings. It's incredible to be there. And I think when people can go from that constant searching and seeking for external, you know, justification, external happiness to come inside them, to then take a moment to focus on what's going on inside and be familiar with that. And that's what a lot of what I do in the practices I teach in meditation, whether it's, you know, teaching yoga to a couple hundred grade school kids in a gym, or running a strength program, which I did this morning in the park with a bunch of dads at 5:30 in the morning, doing push-ups in the rain, because we're just trying to get back into what's happening right now in the present moment. I think when we can show up and be present, however we are, and be comfortable with that feeling, I think that's another key part of it, is that we need to talk about, it's okay to feel lonely. It's okay to feel sad. It is perfectly natural. We all experience it. Probably a lot more than we would, you know, vocalize, but we do. That's just part of the human experience. When you see something, the grass is greener on the other side, or you see this external validation or this incredibly curated experience through these digital tools, you can't help but feel lonely or feel less than. And so what I do with a lot of my practices, whether it's strength training in the park, teaching yoga, teaching meditation, or just talking to people randomly about weightlifting, which happens a lot more than I planned on, is just coming back to that feeling that, you know, you are good enough just by being here. Whenever I close out yoga classes, I always say the same thing and say, you know, my name is Patrick. the light in me recognizes the light in you. And all I can say is thank you, thank you, thank you. Just being grateful for being here with each other, I think, is one of the biggest things that we can do to get past that feeling of isolation and loneliness and kind of get back to that present moment with each other.
Now, Patrick, the author, talks quite a bit about the online, you know, many young people are online now, that's how they are connecting. But then in the quote that I read, you know, that we are connected more than ever through technology. I mean, with so many people kind of connecting online, how important is it for people to come together, and how do you kind of promote that with the work that you do?
That's a great question. I think it's fascinating that we have these devices in our pockets where we can literally talk to someone on the other side of the world, yet we sometimes struggle to talk to the person next to us in a random chit-chat conversation. And it's something that I think when we can be comfortable with where we're at in a given moment and not try and put on this mask of like, oh, I'm doing so well, and let me, you know, talk about all the great things I'm doing, and just be like, oh, I'm, you know, a simple question. How you doing, Bill? Oftentimes people say, I'm good, or I'm great. Well, are you? Like, are you really doing good? Or maybe you just, that's the built-in response that we have. So I think being a little more comfortable with that, we can be open and honest with ourselves, first and foremost. We can be open and honest with other people around us. And so what I do is bring people together through different, you know, yoga, fitness programs, things like that. I do Pogi the Yogi, which is where I go and teach yoga to grade school kids. And we do videos, and we go do things at the library. And it's, you know, everything from 5 kids in a small classroom to a couple hundred kids in a gymnasium. And the lessons I always come back to is that no matter where you're at in life or where you're at in this given day, in this moment, it's okay because you're here. And that's a lot to be grateful for, just the fact that we're here, we're walking, talking, and even folks that are differently abled, maybe they're not walking, but whatever it is, like, we're here. And like, that's amazing. And we can find the awe and the wonder in the everyday things in life. Like, just look at a leaf. The structure of a leaf is fascinating. And Joe may know more about this because I think he has more of a scientific background, but I think if we can find that wonder and that inspiration in the everyday moments, it gives such a gravity to how we show up in that moment. And whenever I close the Pogi the Yogi sessions, I always have kids repeat a phrase after me, and it says, I am wonderful as I am right now. And that's something that I teach that to kids. I say it to myself all the time because I think just coming back to that present moment and realizing that we're here. We are here, so let's take a deep breath and be here.
Well, for the past couple of years, I had the honor of sitting next to Imani on the Common Council. I'm over on the west side. Imani's over on the east side, but, you know, it gave us a chance to connect. Now, Patrick, you talked about a couple of activities and events that go on the west side. I want to kind of close out our first book with Imani, maybe talking about some of the events and things that bring people together over on the east side.
Yeah, and so when you were talking about, you know, community and, you know, people getting together as Alder, I had 23 in-person sessions, and I participated with others to do about 47. And what I was really, really surprised at the entire time is people kept showing up, right? I'm thinking, okay, there's going to be 2 people. There's 50, 60, 70. They keep showing up. And what was cool, what I did is I feel like I facilitated connecting the community. So in District 12, I feel like I connected one neighborhood who has its their own history and their own set of values and their own area to other neighborhoods to see that we all are connected to solve these different issues. And that's one of the things that I thought was cool about the book club, Bill, was that it gave people a chance to be human, right? I saw you as human. I saw you as talking. I was there the day that you were talking about what you did. And I think that's what we miss with the phones is we don't have to be Instagram ready. We don't have to be perfect. And we're all in this together. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what I think.
Let's move on to our next book. The time is 1:24, and you're listening to Madison BookBeat here on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host for today's show, Bill Tischler. Our topic for today is book clubs and books that build community and raise awareness about issues of concern in the Madison area. The next book we're going to be discussing is a 1962 book, Silent Spring, written by Rachel Carson. Carson was deeply concerned about the deadly poisons hidden in our foods and water supply. Using her skill as both a writer and a scientist, Carson wished to, quote, frighten the country by a picture of what chemical companies are doing to the public. When Silent Spring was published in 1962, it fundamentally altered the way we think about the environment and helped launch the modern environmental movement. Earlier this year, Silent Spring was the topic of a District 11 book club, where Joe Grande was one of the facilitators in the discussion. Now, I should say that this is Arbor Week, and tomorrow is Earth Day. So I want to kind of start with you, Joe, and maybe have you kind of share some of the highlights from the book club discussion you participated in, and also how Silent Spring may have influenced you in your career.
All right. Thank you, Bill. I find Silent Spring to be a fairly accessible scientific textbook, one that talks a lot about the interconnections within nature and within the environment. It has a focus on some of the various cycles, the chemical cycles, like the nitrogen cycle, the water cycle, the relationship between organisms within the food chains and the food webs. And one of the things in particular, my favorite chapter, of course, is chapter 5, which talks about the soil ecosystem. And I think it's poetic. I think it's beautiful. In terms of there were various perspectives that were shared at the book club. And I think those perspectives were informed by when people read that book. So for me, for example, I was introduced to Silent Spring in the late 80s and early 90s. And depending on when you read it, you might have a gloomy perspective or a more optimistic perspective. And I'll share the fact that I have kind of an optimistic perspective when I read or when I read Silent Spring and when I reread Silent Spring. And I think some of that comes from during this time. It was 20 years or 30 years after the publication of this book, and there's been a lot of progress. Prior to this book, rivers were on fire. We couldn't breathe the air, couldn't really drink the water. We were really destroying the environment, and a lot of things changed with this book. And so by the time that I'm reading this book, a lot of that federal legislation had been passed to start to protect the environment. And so some of the things that I think about is we talk about Silent Spring. Just this past week, you know, I hear sandhill cranes all the time. I saw a bald eagle driving down John Nolan, and I see loons in Monona Bay when I bike to work most days. This time of year, of course, not all the time, but there's a short window where we see loons in Monona Bay. So if it's not clear, this book is pretty foundational to me. And as a resource manager, it informs a lot of my decision making and my thinking about how humans interact with the environment, similar to some of the ideas that Patrick was just describing earlier. There is a sense of wonder, and I think that's, you know, a phrase that comes from Rachel Carson in Silent Spring, or if not Silent Spring, another one of her books. There is a sense of wonder of the environment and the world around us if we just open our eyes to it. And like I said, lots of optimism because there are so many positive things that have happened since the book was originally published in the 60s.
Now, Silent Spring was written back in 1962, and it's a very sophisticated piece of political writing aimed at changing the government from the inside. Rachel Carson knew that the government would only pass tough new legislation on pesticides if the public's perception of the problem changed. Carson knowingly wrote the book to capture the attention of President Kennedy and the First Lady. Now, testifying before the Senate Committee on Commerce in 1963, just before her death, she revealed the motive behind writing Silent Spring.
In the course of more than 5 years, I have spent an intensive study of the pesticide problem. I have arrived at the conclusion that the conflicts inherent in this problem can only be solved by an independent board of commission to be set up at the level of the executive office.
So here we are some 60 years later, and we find that many of the landmark legislation set up to protect and monitor our environment are being eroded by the current Trump administration. Joe, I'd be interested to hear if you see any parallels between the concerns that Rachel Carson raised in Silent Spring back in 1962 and the challenges we're facing today with cuts to these programs at the national level.
Sure. I'd like to start by just quoting a couple of sentences from Silent Spring, where Carson states, "And when millions of tons of poisonous chemicals are applied to the surface of the land, it is inevitable that some of them will find their way into the ceaseless cycle of waters moving between land and sea." She further writes, "To assume that we must resign ourselves to turning our waterways into rivers of death is to follow the counsel of despair and defeatism. We must make wiser use of alternative methods that are now known, and we must devote our ingenuity and resources to developing others." And to answer your question specifically, I see lots of parallels between the focus in Silent Spring, where the focus is on organic, human-made pesticides. And again, the term organic is used very differently in Silent Spring than what we in our current lexicon, where organic means more natural, whereas organic here is containing carbon-based pesticides. And those chemicals that are used to kill weeds and bugs. But today, a similar book could be written about road salt and the impact of road salt on the environment, or more specifically, PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, because I see a lot of parallels between the two. There are alternatives that exist. And for the example of road salt, why do we use road salt? It's a public safety measure that allows us to drive at posted or above posted speed limits in the worst possible weather conditions in winter. There are alternatives, and those alternatives involve us taking a step back and scraping away or physically removing the snow and ice from roadways and sidewalks, not relying on some chemical agent to do that. As a society, however, we've decided that road salt is an inexpensive and convenient way to clear roadways quickly and allow us to get on our busy days and do the things that we need to or want to do. Similarly, the same can be said for PFAS, and I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit more about that shortly.
And Joe, you work for the city of Madison and the water resource manager, and you just mentioned PFAS, and I guess I need to ask is you know, how safe is Madison drinking water? What are the concerns about PFAS in our water supply?
I think Madison residents should have confidence in their tap water. Residents should know that it's rigorously tested, and the results of that testing are transparently shared on our website, madisonwater.org. So that information certainly is available. I know that there is some concern about PFAS and whether PFAS is in our water or not. PFAS, which stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. This is a class of human-made chemicals that have been used for decades, and they are used to put non-stick and stain-resistant or waterproof properties in many consumer goods. They've been used for decades. They are found in air, water, soil, and the blood of humans and wildlife around the world. Doesn't have to be in your urban centers, virtually anywhere in the world. This is true. PFAS in the local environment generally arise from the Dane County Airport and the Wisconsin Air National Guard, where fire-fighting foams have been used for training purposes and or fire protection services at the airport. They've drained from the airport, or they've seeped into the groundwater, which then feeds into Starkweather Creek, makes its way into Lake Monona, and then continues down the Yahara chain of lakes. Excuse me. Just want to make sure I get this all right. In addition to that contamination, there has been PFAS detected at an Eastside well. That Eastside well was taken out of service in March of 2019, so it hasn't operated in 6 years because of PFAS. We're currently on the tail end of a process to add a PFAS filtration or treatment system to remove the PFAS, and by later this summer, we'll be delivering PFAS-free water from that well again, and I'm pretty excited about that progress that's being made there. Again, I would say that, you know, Madison tap water is not the greatest risk for PFAS in our experience here in the city of Madison. The greatest risk is from eating fish that come from Lake Monona and other downstream water bodies from that, due to the bioaccumulation of that PFAS in the fish tissue. So we do find occasionally some low levels of PFAS in our drinking water, but know that, you know, we have our eyes on the ball. We do twice annual testing of PFAS for all of our active wells, and we report that information on our website so customers have access to that information. The analogies, again, to Silent Spring is that those pesticides that were described in Silent Spring, there's those analogies where these PFAS will continue to reside, the residual amounts of them will reside long after they've been used, just because they don't readily break down.
Now, Amani, I believe the well is in that Joe talked about is in your district?
Yes.
You know, when you're the alder for District 12, you made efforts to recognize Dr. Maria Powell's decades-long environmental justice work and advocacy around PFAS contamination. Can you talk about that and I guess the recognition that you worked to bring light to Madison people?
Yeah, so it's not there yet. It's the pre-advocacy level, but I do want to say a couple of things, and I'll talk about that in just a second. So I was on Water Utility Board, and prior to that, I would not drink the water, Madison water. But through learning and through understanding the process and through the deep knowledge that these guys have been working on and doing, I came home one day after Water Utility Board and I said, we are all drinking the water. We're not buying any more outside water. And I went right to the sink and I've been drinking it ever since. It's delicious, by the way. And I appreciate Dr. Powell, even that I didn't get to know her. All right. When I came on as alder, she was sick and then passed away. But I got to know her friends and I got to know the people at the Water Utility in the board and others in the neighborhood, of all people that District 12 wanted to talk about when I came on as alder, it was Dr. Maria Powell. And if I could, I'd put her face up on my, you know, in my office, because I think she's a hero. And the reason is she did not allow us as a city to reduce or deflect our responsibility to do something. She went after everybody over and over and over and over again. The guys at the Water Utility will tell you, she was there day in, day out as a community, building community, and she built the community that changed things for PFAS in Madison, Wisconsin. So I'm no longer alder, but one of the things that I've been doing, and I know it's sensitive, is I've been talking to people who knew her, who are continuing her work, the environmentalists, and asking them to talk to her husband about renaming the well after her and having a community plaque, educational plaque that teaches us about our activism, our right to be deep, our right to know that this is it here, right now. We're in community. If we have a problem, we work on it. She worked on it 15 years. And so hopefully my councilmate one day, Alder Tischler, will take it up, the resolution that I wrote, after they figure out if that's what their family wants to do, if her family wants to do this. Because she laid it home, and she's the reason that we have water that we can drink, and the water utility recognizing that and doing something about it. It's like, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but we're like very few in the nation that have this new system. It's going to be a huge deal, right?
Yeah, there's very few that have gotten to the point of implementing PFAS treatment. So for sure. And we expect to be one of the first here in the state of Wisconsin.
So we've become environmentalists, and we've delivered on what we've said. And this goes back to connecting Silent Springs to the Arctic community. You have an issue that you know is for real and will affect a lot of people. And then in community, you solve it. There's a lot of fights. There's a lot of discussions. There's a lot of back and forth. And eventually, your three-year-old will drink the water and they will live a longer life because people came together to solve a problem. It doesn't get any better than that.
Well, I remember when we were doing the Art of Community, the book talk, one of our speakers talked about how we're all connected through the water that we drink and through the air that we breathe. And so that was a very hopeful message. And I thank you for all the advocacy work that you're doing. And yes, I will make an effort. I will bring that resolution forward to honor the work of Dr. Maria Powell. Doing a time check here. The time is 1:41, and you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. The show is Book Beat, and I am your host, Bill Tischler. The topic for today that we're talking about is book clubs, and book clubs as a way to create community and raise awareness about important issues in our city. Joining me in the studio is Amani Latimer Burris, Joe Grande, Patrick Cunningham, and Ben Varick. We're going to turn to our third book, and that's the book Killed by a Traffic Engineer. Now, first I want to say that last year, the District 11 Book Club read A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next, published in 2021. This is a book that went into the history of transportation, the evolution of public transit, and the way automobiles have shaped American cities over the past year. Now, I chose this book because a big part of the area that I represent on the west side of Madison was built in the late 1950s and 60s, and was really designed around the automobile. We have wide streets and boulevards. Everybody seems to have a two-car garage, and we had lots of shopping malls with huge parking lots. Now, one of the books I was considering for the District 11 Book Club was Wes Marshall's 2024 book, Killed by a Traffic Engineer, Shattering the Delusion that Science Underlies Our Transportation System. Now, to be honest, I didn't select this book because of the concerns I had with the title, Killed by a Traffic Engineer. And as an elected official, I thought the title would be difficult to get city staff to show up and participate in the book club and possibly get the public to attend. I kind of, looking back now, I regret not having selected this book. But as fate would have it, a few months after I did the book talk on A Brief History of Motion, members from Machinery Road Bicycles, the Madison Bikes, and Wisconsin Bike Federation invited me for coffee and asked if I would participate in a new book club they were organizing. And they offered this book club earlier this year. Joining me in the studio is one of the organizers of the book club, Ben Varick. Ben, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Bill. I appreciate it.
Now, Ben, I'm going to start by asking what inspired you and others to create the Bicycle Book Club, and why did you select the book Killed by a Traffic Engineer?
Yeah. So I work for the Wisconsin Bike Fed as the youth programs manager in Dane County. And my job is to help kids throughout Dane County walk and bike and take the bus to school. And as part of my job, I go into schools all over and I talk to a lot of students and a lot of families about their kids' transportation and the barriers in those to that transportation. And many of the folks that I talk with have pretty strong opinions about the transportation system that they live in, right? I imagine that many of our listeners today have strong opinions about the transportation system. Many folks want to live in a walkable, safe, and comfortable neighborhood, a place where kids can walk or bike to school or to their friend's house. And we can build the roads accordingly, but most people aren't traffic engineers, and they don't know how to advocate for those design features that builds the sort of safe and comfortable neighborhood that they want to live in. And this book does a great job of introducing some of those traffic engineering concepts to folks who don't have a background in traffic engineering to give them a voice so they can advocate for the design of the public roads that they want to see. So Lauren Barlow, who is working for Machinery Row Bicycles, approached me and said, "Hey, I'm interested in doing a book club. Are you interested in co-hosting it?" And together we decided that this book would be a great way to give people the tools so that they could advocate for their roads and to bring folks together.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me over to have coffee and talking about about participating in this book club. I started off as alder, and I really wasn't on the best of terms, I guess I'd say, with the bike community. I wanted to save some trees on Mineral Point Road and a couple other things. But I think by having a chance to participate in the book club, I think it really allowed me to kind of connect with this community. And I wanted to kind of ask you, can you kind of describe the bike community here in Dane County and the city of Madison? And how does this new book club fit into this community? And what value does it add?
Sure. So the bike community here in Madison and Dane County is quite disparate, right? There are some folks who are really experienced road bicyclists who are in spandex going really fast down roads. There's folks who are hardcore bike commuters who, when it's negative 10 degrees and sleeting, they're biking with their studded tires. And then there's all sorts of other folks, right? There's kids who bike to school. I was talking with someone the other day and I asked, if they bike, if they're a bicyclist, and they're like, "Oh, I'm not a bicyclist." And I'm like, "But they said that they do bike sometimes." And I asked where they biked, and they're like, "Well, I bike to my job most days on campus." And I was like, "Oh, it's really interesting that here's somebody who bikes most days but doesn't consider themselves a bicyclist, right? They're part of the bike community too, right? We want to build a city where folks feel comfortable biking without having to be a spandex-clad bicyclist, right? That's the goal. And so our bike community is wide and covers a lot of walks of life. And so the one of the goals of the book club was to bring some of those folks in who maybe aren't as confident, don't maybe hold that identity as a bicyclist, and bring them in and give them tools for the traffic engineering vocabulary and tools to advocate for what would be comfortable for them, right? If you only have the really confident folks advocating for road design, they might advocate for a different sort of design than the 12-year-old who wants to get to school, right? What's comfortable for different people varies quite widely. And we wanted folks to meet each other, right? That was why the Bicycle Book Club was held in person and over multiple weeks. And each week we tried to have folks get to know each other and break into small groups so that people could get to know other bicyclists in their neighborhood and use that to build community. And something that struck me in our earlier discussion about the art of community was how much our city's infrastructure impacts your connection to community. And if everyone could for a moment think through this thought experiment with me, imagine if everybody on your street or in your neighborhood were to leave their homes at the same time and get into a car and start driving somewhere, you would have a traffic jam, right? There perhaps might be frustration or hostility, there'd be lots of honking. Now imagine if everybody on your street left their home and either walked or biked somewhere. It would be a party, right? It'd be a block party. It'd be great. You'd meet your neighbors that perhaps you hadn't talked to before. You'd find some connection with somebody that you didn't have before. And I think about that as I bike as my main form of transportation, and the way I can connect to my community when I'm biking is so much more intimate than when I'm driving my car. And so I think, right, the Bike Book Club both brought people together for the book club, and then hopefully helps to create a set of infrastructure that builds communities in neighborhoods all over the city.
And one population that was invited was actual city traffic engineers. I think it was on the second week of the book club. So we got a chance to hear directly from the people who this book is kind of aimed at. And I wanted, one of the chapters that I kind of like, or at least the title certainly jumped out at me, was in the book, Killed by a Traffic Engineer, was chapter 6, Won't Someone Please Think of the Children? Patrick, if you could maybe read one of the paragraphs from that.
Sure. Parents ask for a crosswalk and pedestrian signal. Traffic engineers say there aren't enough pedestrians crossing the street to warrant them. Now, let's say we do put in a pedestrian signal. Traffic engineers will time it for a healthy, determined adult rather than an inattentive, meandering kid. Whatever the case, let's say a kid gets hurt crossing the street. Who's at fault? It might be the driver. It could be the kid. In the court of public opinion, it could be the parents for letting their kid walk on a dangerous street, or the school for letting the parents let their kid walk on a dangerous street. It could even be an act of God, like an icy street. It's never the traffic engineer.
Yeah, it's never the traffic engineer. Ben, can you kind of comment your work with the Wisconsin Bike Federation, and you work with kids. What do you think of this quote?
Yeah, this hits home for me. Right, oftentimes we blame the kid, like, oh, the kid wasn't wearing a helmet. I hear that a lot, right? And helmets are great. I love helmets. But oftentimes that wasn't the cause of the crash, right? And when you see a crash at the same intersection 4 or 5 times over and over and over again, and you can guess next year there'll probably be another crash there again, and the year after that there'll be a few more, right? That's no longer an accident, right? That's a poorly designed intersection. Let's change that intersection. Right, we want to live in a world in which kids can walk to school, and we also live in a world in which we're all fallible, right? People are going to make mistakes. Drivers are going to be drowsy. They're going to be distracted. And so we need to build a road system, a transportation system that lets people be safe with our understood humanity.
Yeah, we don't need to wait until we have an accident. We need to be planning ahead. That's the whole idea of a planner. I know in my district I have a couple of streets that are very difficult to cross, especially for young people. And most recently with the change in the mass and bus schedule, and the bus, the start and stop time of our middle schools, many of the kids who would normally walk to school and cross, actually it's Mineral Point is the road, the middle school kids found that they no longer had a crossing guard, because the crossing guards in the city of Madison are only there for elementary schools. And you know, over in the Hamilton and Van Hees, Hamilton Middle School and Van Hees Elementary School, in the past, they were all, the start and stop time of the school day was in sync. And so because of busing, the change in the bus schedules, the middle school started later, and the kids found that there was no crossing guard there. So, you know, so I am, you know, very concerned about how we can make it safer, especially near our schools. You know, so that parents don't feel the need to you know, pack, and parents and caregivers don't feel the need to kind of pack kids into their minivan and drop them off at school, because that's only making the situation worse. So you know, so we need to be, especially near our schools, that's where we should be having the safest place to walk and bike. But oftentimes we're finding that that's not the case. Yeah, do you want to? I mean, that's my little rant there, but can you comment on that?
Yeah, and I absolutely agree, and I think the city is doing a pretty good job of advocating and making those changing those changes, prioritizing those changes near schools. Right now I'm involved with the city in a process, the Safe Routes to School plans, where the city is going through and the school district are going through each school in the district and in a systematic way and coming up with a plan, both the road changes near that school and other sorts of changes that will improve the safety of kids walking and biking to school. And this afternoon we're going to be at Hamilton Middle School. We're starting a bike club there to try to boost the number of students that are biking to school and get kids excited about biking. And
perfect. And actually, my youngest attends Hamilton, so I thank you for that for your advocacy work there. Now we talked about the book club that you set up, kind of divided over a course of several weeks. We talked about, you know, the different populations, but what's one of the outcomes that you wanted from the book club discussion, bicycle book club discussion?
That's a good question. So our goal was to bring people into the bike advocacy community who maybe hadn't been a part of it before, right? And to give people the tools so that they could advocate for the sorts of changes that they thought would be the most useful. And so the third session, our bike book club is broken into three sessions. The first session was small group discussions about the book. The second session, we invited city staff from traffic engineering to come in. One reason was this book is fairly critical of traffic engineers, right, with the title Killed by a Traffic Engineer. And I want to emphasize that in many cases, this book, kind of divides traffic engineering practices into this is the way most traffic engineers do things, and then there's this other way, this new way that's a lot better. And in a lot of cases, right, the city of Madison's traffic engineering department is already doing the new better way. And so I wanted to emphasize that, and I wanted to bring in these professional traffic engineers to talk to us who don't have a background in traffic engineering about what are some of the specific barriers to implementing these changes in the city of Madison, and what are some of the intricacies, and to give an opportunity for members of the community to chat about specifics with those traffic engineers. And so I was really grateful for that response from the city and for them participating in our book club. And then the third session was we broke up the group. So each of these book clubs, there's about 40 to 60 folks that showed up. One of them was scheduled on the same day as the Super Bowl, which was my fault. So that third session we broke into smaller groups, focused on the parts of town that people were interested in advocating for change, right? I live near Park Street and near Fish Hatchery, and so that's a part of the city that I care deeply about personally, right? And then I work with students in schools all over the city, and so I care about those spots. And other people who attended have other parts of the city that they prioritize. And so the focus of the third session was to give people an opportunity to find the other folks that were also interested in their part of the city. So there were folks that were interested in Regent Street and Rosa Road. There were folks that were interested in Fish Hatchery. There were folks that were interested in the multi-use path along University and Highland Avenue. And it gave those groups opportunities to come together and to plan. And the book club has inspired, and this was really our goal, a monthly bike advocacy meeting hosted at Machinery Row with Madison Bikes. So the first Sunday of every month, 5 to 6:30 p.m. at Machinery Row Bicycles is the bike advocacy meetup. And those are a way to keep those conversations going. And so I invite you, if you're interested in, there's a part of town that you think can be improved, to show up to those meetings, or if you just want to come and listen to what other people are talking about. It's a great way to stay in the loop. And that was our hope from this book club, was to inspire that sort of continued community and that continued advocacy.
So Killed by a Traffic Engineer was your first book. What's the next book you're looking at having for your bicycle book club?
That's a good question. I'm not sure which book we'll pick, but one book that I'm pretty excited to read next is City Limits by Megan Kimball. It's a book about communities in Texas that have been working and organizing to stop some highway expansion projects that are really dividing communities in their area. And I want to read that book.
Yeah, well, that does it for our show. I want to thank my guests, Imani Latimer-Burris, Joe Grande, Patrick Cunningham, and Ben Varick, for joining me in the studio today. We've been talking about the book, The Art of Community, Seven Principles of Belonging. We've been talking about Silent Spring and Killed by a Traffic Engineer. Thanks to our production team today. That's engineer Andrew Thompson, receptionist Andrew Lutzke, and Sarah Gabor. I'm your host, Bill Tischler. You're listening to Mass and Bookbeat here on community radio station, WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Coming up next is 3 hours of jazz with Alex Wilding White. Keep it tuned here for this afternoon, but first, the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
Hello, this is Evan Vodak, lead singer of the band Voltsia. We are a rock and heavy metal band from Madison and letting you know to tune in this Monday, April 21st from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. on WORT 89.9 FM Access Hour for a full live performance. Also, the last 10 minutes will be saved to hear more about our upcoming shows and our new single Love No Human and more. Thank you very much.
Make Music Madison is back on June 21st for the 13th annual day of free outdoor live music across the city. Here's how you can get involved. Online registration for musicians to participate and venues to schedule events is open through June 1st at makemusicmadison.org. All genres and styles of music are welcome, and there are no age limits or skill levels required. The Make Music Madison website is used to match artists who need a stage with venues who seek performers. At noon on June 20th, matchmaking ends and all shows must be confirmed in the system. Again, advance registration for venues and musicians at makemusicmadison.org closes at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, June 1st. And mark your calendars for Make Music Day on Saturday, June 21st. Bringing you a variety of music every day of the year. This is WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services.